There's the big board, the 20 electoral votes from the state of Pennsylvania. We just got new metrics in.
Right now, a historic moment. We can now project the winner of the presidential race.
The inauguration of a president celebrates a peaceful transition of power engineered by the American voters.
The president-elect of the United States of America, Donald Trump.
Donald J. Trump is the president of the United States elect.
This is a political upset of huge, huge magnitude.
Country still divided.
This is your life now. This is our election now. This is us. This is our country. It's real.
Hi and welcome, listeners of the 45th Podcast. We are very excited to have a special guest with us on this week, Governor Michael Dukakis. Now, you may remember, Governor Dukakis was the longest-serving governor of Massachusetts in history, and he was the Democratic nominee for the presidency in 1988. Today, Governor Dukakis is a professor at Northeastern University, where he teaches political science, I believe, correct?
Political science, public policy, and I do the same at UCLA.
Great. Thank you so much and welcome.
Great. Good to be with you.
So, I don't know if you have been listening to our podcast. If you have, that would be really awesome. But just in case you haven't, we are called the 45th because we follow everything coming out of the 45th administration. And we are kind of obsessed with it. So, my first question to you is, how closely are you following this administration?
Closely, as I think most Americans are.
It's hard to imagine a time that there's been more interest and more, I guess, almost obsession with what's going on in the White House than now. At least not that since I've been following.
Well, it's not unprecedented. I mean, look, most of us try to follow new administrations in particular very closely. What makes this different is that we've got a guy in the White House who, for one thing, lost by 3 million votes under what I think is a continuing crazy system, this electoral college, which should have been abolished 200 years ago. And I would say that in a very nonpartisan way. I mean, if John Kerry had gotten 60,000 more votes in the state of Ohio in 2004, he would have become president of the United States, even though George W. Bush had 3 million more votes than he did. Equally ridiculous, equally unfair. So we start with that and with a guy who obviously he's an interesting personality, to put it mildly. You know, every day is another gong show in the White House. That doesn't mean that he may not accomplish some things, but it does make what's going on, for one thing, interesting, occasionally amusing, often very frustrating, and at least in the case of foreign policy, very risky, because we're dealing with a situation now which in some ways, in terms of world history, is very promising, but in other ways could be very, very dangerous. And you've got a guy who's a real novice when it comes to dealing with foreign policy and says things that he doesn't know much about or eventually regrets. And that can be really very serious. And obviously, it's worth following closely.
Do you follow Trump on Twitter at all?
No, I'm not a Twitter person. You know, us old folks don't understand this. I mean, I try to finish the New York Times by the time I fall asleep at night. I don't know where you Twitter guys find the time. I mean, I'm a very busy guy. I teach a lot. I do all kinds of other stuff. I wouldn't have time in the day to sit down in front of a
computer. That's why a president. That's why the president tweets at 3 a.m. mostly. I think his
I understand that. And maybe he doesn't need – I mean, I'm not a – you know, I'm about a five-hour sleeper, but I do need 5 hours. And I certainly don't wake up and start getting active at 3 a.m. So his routine is kind of interesting. But by and large, I think the tweeting has gotten him into trouble a lot more than it's helped. And my own feeling is that he ought to stop tweeting and start acting and working like a president so we get some consistency and some sense of what is really going on in the White House and how he is going to try to make this a better and great place. So far, it's been kind of a wild first 100 days.
Yeah, I do think that, you know, part of, as you mentioned, you know, the entertainment value. I mean, this is seems very much like almost a reality show following this president with the dozens of headlines out of the White House every single day almost, and the tweets and the very odd, his interactions and comments every time he's got a press briefing or some kind of a meeting with a foreign head of state. There's always something to talk about here. But I wanted to back up a little bit before the presidency began, and you know, we all had great hopes that once he was inaugurated, he would become presidential. And I think that ship has sailed. I don't know if there's hope for that at this point. But you know, the conversations still continue, and the think pieces still come out about what went wrong in this election. Where did the Democratic Party go wrong? Was Hillary Clinton just a terrible candidate? And I'm asking you that because you teach political science, and so maybe you can enlighten us on what you think could have been done better.
Well, remember, you're talking to somebody who couldn't get himself elected, so I'm no expert. And I made some mistakes.
You live and you learn.
In the 88 campaign, but that is true. I mean, you know, the Greeks have an old saying, pathipa mathima. Things happen, you're supposed to learn from them. And that's particularly true when it comes to politics. And one of the things that I did not do well at all in 1988 was to do what I had done in every other election that I'd ever run in. And that was to build a strong precinct-based grassroots organization. Now, what does that mean? Precinct, as you know, is kind of the basic election unit with a polling place. Roughly has 3,000 voters. And we have 185,000 precincts in the United States. The Democratic Party, and I know Tom Perez, the new party chairman, has committed this. The Democratic Party has got to go out and recruit a precinct captain in every one of those 185,000 precincts. That should not be difficult in a nation of 320 million people. And that precinct captain, in turn, goes out and recruits six neighborhood captains. And the job of that precinct organization, those seven people, is to make personal contact on an ongoing basis with every single voting household, Democrat, Republican, or Independent. No reds, no blues, no purples. We've got to get out of that and start getting serious about running a 50-state campaign. Now, Tom Perez, the new Democratic National Chairman, has committed this. But it's how you organize it, what you do. And we happen to have a terrific opportunity to test this out now with the congressional elections coming up in less than 2 years. Howard Dean, when he was party chairman, 2005-2006, did precisely this. He was criticized for it. But precisely this, he said, we're going to run a 50-state campaign. And we did, and we took over the Congress. So it's clear that this works. And it doesn't cost a lot of money, obviously, because these are largely volunteers who are doing this kind of work. But it's absolutely critical. We cannot continue to write off half the country.
So at the same time, though, I know one criticism that in the last campaign is that in the aftermath is that why was Hillary trying to work on Nevada? Why was she not trying to show up at the base? Why was she trying to expand other states? So there was a sort of negative pushback there.
Look, she was with a month to go, she was tied in Texas. She was up a little bit in Georgia and down a little bit in South Carolina. Why didn't she win them? There was no field operation. Why not? Well, they were red states, quote unquote, which is absolute nonsense. I mean, these are states largely made up of middle-class Americans, not terribly wealthy, working hard, trying to support themselves and their families. I mean, why would they be, quote, red states? And once you buy into this, once you essentially say, well, we're not interested in half the country, that sends out a message. You may not be aware of it, but it sends out a message which basically says, well, we're not interested in these folks. Look, I carried West Virginia in 1988 by 12 percentage points. When did it become red? Iowa, now we're told, is getting kind of reddish. I carried that state by 10 percentage points. Texas, in the next few years, will become 40% Latino, 20% African American. It's a red state, but you're not going to crack through this unless you basically say, we're going to campaign at the grassroots on a precinct-by-precinct basis in every one of the 50 states, no exceptions. And that's the task before us, and there's no reason under the sun why we shouldn't be able to do that.
So, Governor, can I ask you, I mean, you seem to be saying that the Clinton campaign's ground game wasn't up to par. But what about, like, this kind of rise in liberal populism is the way I'm looking at this? Because if you look at, not only would I say the Democratic Party miscalculated, but the GOP miscalculated too. I don't think anybody expected that Donald Trump would be the candidate of the GOP party. And so it seems like they also did not understand where their base is. And I'm wondering about what the strength of this very right-wing populism is, and the dynamic between that and the ground game. If you have an entirely new kind of sentiment that's rising up and really kind of washing over both political parties between Sanders and Trump, then will a ground game even help?
Well, let me say just a few things about this. First, there's nothing new about this. I was defeated for re-election for governor of Massachusetts the first time out by a guy who, from a personal personality standpoint, wasn't like Trump. But he was saying a lot of the same things. In my own primary, I came back and beat him 4 years later. But we've had this. I mean, I lived through the McCarthy era. Who was this guy McCarthy? Guy from Wisconsin who terrorized the country, accusing people of being disloyal, unpatriotic fellows, travelers, subversives. I mean, there was a whole vocabulary of folks that this guy and his supporters developed. So, you know, Father Coughlin was this guy on radio back in the late 30s, middle of the recession, middle of the New Deal. Anti-Semitic, anti-Roosevelt, terrible guy, but he had millions and millions of followers. So it's not as if we haven't seen this before. On the other hand, Donald Trump is no populist. I don't know why people keep referring to him as a populist. He's got a cabinet that's loaded with billionaires. He's for tax cuts for the rich. He's for essentially destroying our environmental regulatory system. He has filed a budget that has deep cuts in affordable housing and education, all of these things that are of benefit to average middle-class Americans. He's no populist, nor are the people around him.
Would nativist be the right word? How would
I mean, you know, America first for most
nationalist
of us involves nativist, anti-Semitic, anti-minority kinds of stuff. You may, but let's not call him a populist. He's no populist. I mean, this guy, you know, he's basically a rich billionaire who has a political philosophy which really believes that if you give the rich the bucks, somehow the rest of us will prosper. Most of us call that trickle-down economics, and it doesn't work. So this guy's no populist. But he clearly tapped into some very strong feelings on the part of a lot of, you know, average middle-class Americans who, for a variety of reasons, were not happy with the status quo, and in many cases justifiably so, even though the Obama administration brought us back from a Republican disaster of an economy and basically presented Trump with a pretty decent economic situation after a very difficult years. But this guy's he's no populist. I mean, he's basically a right-wing billionaire whose policies, for the most part, are just enthusiastic trickle-down economics.
Does he even have policies?
How many times are we going to do this? Because it doesn't work before we wake up to the fact that it doesn't work. It never has.
Hi guys, I've discovered something really big, the best new way to buy business travel. It's called Upside.com. And I'm telling you, if you're not a business traveler, you know someone who is. You have to tell them about Upside. Here's why I love it. Every time you buy a trip at Upside, you save a ton of money. And they give you an Amazon gift card worth $100, $200, even $300 every time. The way they do it is really clever. Upside bundles your flights and hotels together for one low price. Bundled pricing saves money, especially on business travel, so Upside gives you free Amazon gift cards. If you're a frequent business traveler, your company saves a ton of money, and you can get thousands a year for just buying your air and hotel together at Upside. Plus, you still get all your miles. You'd be crazy not to check out Upside.com if you're shopping for business travel. It takes just 3 minutes to see how much you can save by buying your flights and hotel together for one low price. I can't believe it's taken this long for someone to do it. And it gives me the rewards and the convenience in my travel. Check out what we've arranged for you. Use the name BizTrip and you're guaranteed to get at least a $100 Amazon gift card for your first trip. the name BizTrip, that's B-I-Z-T-R-I-P, gets you at least a $100 Amazon gift card for free. How can you not do it? It's a no-brainer. Save big on travel and get a big gift card every trip. I love Upside.com. Upside.com, the best way to travel for business.
I guess for me, I feel like domestically, we have been here, done that. We know that it's not going to work and there's going to be problems to be dealt with. But I think I feel more confident in our ability to sort of weather that storm. For me, it's the foreign policy arena where I have real anxiety, and I think the most damage could be coming down the line.
I agree with you, but I have to tell you that I haven't been happy with American foreign policy generally for a long time, under administrations of both parties. It was really after World War II that this country began engaging actively in international affairs. And that has involved hundreds and hundreds of examples of American interventionism, often with the military, and most of which have been abject failures. And we could go through the whole list. And we're still doing it. If somebody can tell me what the hell we're doing in Syria and what that was all about, and this was under administrations of both parties. Yes, the whole mess in the Middle East started with the Bush invasion of Iraq, which had to be one of the dumbest things we've ever done. But then it got into Afghanistan. And then it was Libya and Syria. And there was an opportunity 5-6 years ago to resolve the Syrian situation with a carefully thought through plan developed by the UN and its special mediator at the time, who was Kofi Annan, the former Secretary General, which included, among other things, a plan for the gradual democratization of Syria, which Assad bought into and supported. And Kofi Annan, the former Secretary General, who was the mediator, having put all of this together, organized a conference to be held in Istanbul of 16 countries, including Syria and Assad, to get this process moving. Nobody seems to remember this. Nobody reports it. It's really crazy. What happened? Does anybody know? Yeah, we blew it up because he invited Iran to be one of the 16 countries. And anybody who knows anything about this situation knows that you can't have a settlement in Syria without Iran. Right. Now, ironically, a year or two later, we began negotiating with Iran. And I think the UN process worked remarkably well under those circumstances. It wasn't just the U.S. and Iran. It was a Security Council, including, by the way, the Russians and the Chinese, who played major roles in that. Mm-hmm. And we got ourselves a pretty darn good agreement on the nuclear side with the Iranians. But we basically said, well, if Iran's going to this conference in Istanbul, we're not going to show up. And we blew up the process. Anand quit in disgust 2 days later. And now we have this humanitarian catastrophe on our hands, which is playing hob with the politics of Europe and Lord knows what, because we didn't want one country at this conference. I mean, this kind of foreign policy doesn't make any sense to me. And I was a fan of President Obama. I thought he was a darn good president. But even he didn't seem to understand that the United States cannot be the world's policeman. I mean, I think that's clear. That either you support a strong UN, which can be the forum for settling these kinds of disputes, or you're going to have the Wild West out there. Right. And all of this happened before Trump showed up. Now, unfortunately, you know, his worst characteristics make this even worse. But we've got to do some serious rethinking in this country about what role this country should play. How should we should conduct ourselves when it comes to foreign policy? And we ought to stop assuming that every time there's a problem somewhere in the world, the United States has got to be there. I think UN has got to be there, but not the United States.
So, Governor, my question to you, I mean, you kind of, in a way, have answered it, but I want to dig a little bit deeper, is this potential solution that may have come to pass or not, because quite frankly, I'm a little bit skeptical about whether Bashar Assad would have actually honored such an agreement. I mean, we don't know. But and I think, you know, the last administration, you know, they did not want to. It seemed like they were very hesitant to get involved in this conflict. They could see that there was
no
really
question. The President right. Obama had learned some lessons and was very, right. very restrained in terms of what he thought we ought to be right. doing.
But if you look at this conflict as a humanitarian crisis, like you said, one that I think is maybe the greatest one we're facing right now on a global scale that is having impact, like you said, on Europe, the United States, all over the Middle East, how does the United States not take any kind of action or stance? I mean, we talked about this a couple of weeks ago on the podcast, and I talked about how for like 6-7 years now, we've been seeing images of Syrians in villages and towns holding signs and tweeting them and sharing them, saying, save us, we're dying, we're being killed. Do we not have a responsibility to be some kind of a moral authority or in the world?
Look, having helped to create this mess, we obviously have a responsibility to try to do something about it. But in my opinion, it must be handled internationally. And whether one likes it or not, that means a strong role for the United Nations, because that's the institution out there that is available to work on these kinds of things. And when we are supportive of the UN, it is remarkably successful.
Right.
The Iranian negotiations being an example of this. But then we kind of decide, well, if the UN doesn't want to go along, we'll do it anyway. That's what happened with Bush in Iraq. And it was a disaster. Is a disaster. Continues to be a disaster. So it's
will
not,
be for decades to come.
You know, I'm a committed internationalist. Don't get me wrong. You can't be the son of Greek immigrants and be an isolationist. But it's got to be in the context of building international framework in which we can resolve these differences peacefully and effectively. Now, that does not mean that somehow the UN is going to magically transform, say, China into a democratic country. That's going to take time. China will be a democracy someday, but it won't be tomorrow. And in the meantime, our relationship with China is one of the most important in the world. If we want to do anything about this crazy kid in North Korea, China has got to be involved. That apparently Trump now understands. So less beating up on China on the economic side, and let's get serious about working with them on these kinds of issues. To John Kerry's credit, he and the Chinese foreign minister negotiated a very impressive climate change agreement. I hope Trump isn't going to mess that up. But it isn't that China can't be an important and constructive part of the world community. It has been doing some things that give us, I think, a reason for optimism about this. But you got to respect them. You got to listen to them. And, you know, we're not going to transform them overnight into a functioning democracy. Look, we got enough problems in our own democracy. We've got about half the states of this country that are trying to disenfranchise minorities and poor people. So we've got some work to do. And we've got a Supreme Court of the United States that essentially held that the reauthorization of the Civil Rights Act was unconstitutional, a terrible, terrible decision. So we've got plenty of work to do here, but in terms of our international posture, I think it is awfully important that we be extremely supportive of a strong United Nations and stop running around. What do we do in Syria right now? Having helped to create this mess, get the UN into it. Let's see if we can somehow create a framework at least to stop the killing and whatever chemical warfare is going on. But let's not assume that somehow, American-supported rebel forces are going to turn the place into a democracy. I mean, I think that's ridiculous.
Right.
What's interesting, though, is that Trump actually, I mean, his, I don't know how many times he said it during the campaign, but his sort of campaign promise was to be isolationist, that he wouldn't intervene, that you vote for him because he will not go overseas and get involved in all these foreign entanglements. And now in office, he's changing course and possibly taking the worst single option, which is getting involved everywhere and doing it alone.
That's very troubling because, in point of fact, I think Trump, in an interesting way, was reflecting the feelings of Americans who are as baffled as I am at what this interventionism is supposed to achieve. And frankly, the one hope I had for the guy was that he would exercise some restraint on this interventionist stuff. Clearly that hasn't happened, and included sending, you know, a fleet of ships in the wrong direction or whatever was happening.
God, that's the most terrifying thing that's happened so far, hands down.
Well, there we are. Does, I think, understand the importance of encouraging China and Russia, for that matter. You know, you don't have to love Putin to recognize the fact that Russia can and must play an important role in the world. And Steven Pinker at Harvard pointed out the other day that 5/6 of the world is conflict-free. That has never, ever happened in the history of mankind until now. And that's pretty impressive. Mm. So it's time for us to go to work on the remaining 1/6. And we're going to need friends and allies to do that. I think that's the kind of role that we want our country to play.
So, Governor, can I ask you, I mean, like, I think you're completely right. We have to be able to respect the national interests of countries like China and Russia and the role they have to play in these affairs. But what about Russian interference in America? Russia is now playing a very large role in what's happening here. And that's a concern. How do you work with a nation, or how do you honor and respect a nation when they are clearly trying to manipulate your domestic affairs and they're interfering in your domestic policies and almost acting like an enemy of your state?
Well, first thing you do is stop considering them an enemy.
And
recognize
okay.
the fact that you got to, I mean, if you can resolve problems, you got to talk with people. Secondly, let me say this to you. I've been around, you know, Kitty and I were depression babies, so we've been around for a long time. No country has interfered more aggressively and actively in the internal affairs of other countries than the United States of America. I mean, we don't just hack them. We overthrow them. I mean, one of the reasons that the Iranians are so unhappy with us is that we overthrew their democratically elected government in 1953. We did the same thing in Guatemala. We did the same thing in Chile. We're still screwing around. And that doesn't justify in any way Russian interference in our political affairs. But, you know, let's be honest with ourselves. I mean, no country has done more of that kind of stuff than the United States, and frankly, we ought to stop it, because all it seems to do is cause problems. Didn't we try to screw up the Iranian nuclear situation with this top secret Stuxnet thing? What were we doing there? Why did we think that was going to work? Didn't we know that at some point it was going to be discovered? It's time that both countries stop stuff, and the way you do that is sit down and talk about it.
Well, not disagreeing with you about the past, what happens there. At the same time, this is a present threat to our sovereignty and also to Europe's as well. And it's ongoing. And given the election in France coming up, it's hard for me to not consider treating Russia as much more of a threat and an enemy than I guess you'd be advocating right now.
Well, I think I disagree with you somewhat. It isn't that I think there's anything good about any country trying to interfere in an international election. I don't care who it is. We've done it. They're doing it. None of these things excuse that kind of behavior. But we'd better get serious about at least having an ongoing constructive dialogue with the Russians and the Chinese and others about these things and get them out on the table. It seems to me that's, at least in my experience, that's the way you resolve problems. You don't turn folks into enemies and then you kind of isolate them and then you wonder why they're reacting the way they're reacting. And I just think it is very important. And in this sense, I commend the president, because I think his discussions with the Chinese president were important. He ought to be discussing things with Putin. And he seems to have some kind of a historic ongoing personal relationship with Putin, but that process of talking, listening, at least trying to respect what these folks are doing, and at the same time raising very constructive criticisms about what you think they're doing, is something that never should stop. Once you start getting angry at them, once you start surrounding them with military alliances and that kind of stuff, then the opportunity for really constructive action goes by the boys. And remember this, though I'm not sure I understand exactly what happened with this latest chemical warfare thing in Syria. It was Putin who convinced Assad to get rid of his chemical weapons, and we helped to take him out. because he understood that the United States and the world generally were very unhappy about the development of chemical weapons by Assad. Russia played an extremely constructive role in the Iranian nuclear agreement. And in fact, are one of the countries that is, if I'm not mistaken, essentially the recipient of Iranian plutonium, which Russia now is responsible for. Those are important roles. And the Chinese role in trying to get North Korea to start behaving is also very important. They're much more, they can be much more effective, the Chinese, than we can be, as I think everybody agrees. So you've got to keep talking, you've got to keep exchanging ideas. And the one thing we don't need is any suggestion that nuclear warfare is acceptable. Yeah. It isn't. It's unconscionable. So I thought we were trying to get rid of them. And I think that's a goal that we and the Russians and the Chinese and everyone else ought to be pursuing very aggressively these days.
Have you read Trump's old ideas on nuclear weapons and how they should be used from like the 80s?
I have not. Tell me about him.
He has this longstanding belief that the way we need, and this is like dating back to seriously like the mid-1980s, is that we need to form an alliance with the other major nuclear power and for us to rule the world together in peace using our nuclear power.
Well, that's crazy. That's crazy. I mean, nuclear warfare is absolutely unacceptable. You know, I spent 2 years, about 16 months of my life in Korea serving the United States Army. And one of the most important days of the 16 months was when I visited Hiroshima. And this was in 1956, just, what, 11 years after we dropped a bomb on them. It was one of the most searing experiences I've ever had. Just walking around that city, looking at people who clearly, physically and psychologically, had been absolutely traumatized by what happened. Now, I'm not suggesting that it may not have been necessary to do that. We told the Japanese we had these weapons. We didn't want to use them. And it was time to surrender. They wouldn't do so. And so President Truman made that decision. But the bomb that was used on Hiroshima and on Nagasaki was a peanut compared to what we have today. And anyone who thinks, look, we've got enough problems trying to deal with this climate problem, and we've got a president in the White House who doesn't seem to understand what's happening to climate. All we need is nuclear warfare. I mean, trust me, civilization as we know it will disappear. And I think that's just intolerable.
You know, you mentioned, you know, your perspective because you had served overseas and seen these things up close and personal. And I do think one of the big issues with the president is that I don't think he spent a lot of time overseas in other societies with other people, understanding them and seeing the world like kind of as one global community. But what do you think about our current Secretary of State? I feel like he is more of a global perspective.
Well, that's true. I mean, he ran a big energy company, which took him all over the world. I think there's a kind of maturity about him and an experience that he has that Trump does not have. On the other hand, and I think most military people will say this to you, essentially turning American national security over to the military is a terrible mistake as well. I mean, we believe in civilian control of the military. I'm impressed with some of the folks that he's appointed to top positions who come out of the military. But they are military people, and they've been trained in military solutions. They seem to be fairly restrained, but they also understand the destruction that modern warfare brings with it. But this chemical attack in Syria, in that roughly that same period of time, what was it, 2 or 3 weeks, we killed 300 innocent people in the Middle East. You know, bombs that weren't supposed to hit certain people and things that happen. You know, we got to be very, very careful. I mean, we're killing kids in Yemen because we're allied with Saudi Arabia, hardly the world's greatest democracy, right?
Right.
And a terrorist nation of its own in many, many ways. This needs really serious rethinking. And
for me, one of the troubling parts of Trump's interventionism is that he's only getting involved in places where he can use bombs. Famine and other crises he's ignoring, even though they arguably have many, many millions worth of lives at risk. But places where he can use a bomb, he seems eager to get involved.
Well, that's a mistake. That's a serious mistake. You know, in an interesting kind of way, even with all the noise that we're hearing these days, many, many parts of the world that have been poor and not well developed and subjected to all kinds of things, and not just military hostilities, I mean health and other things, have come miles over the course of the last couple of decades. I mean, we don't give ourselves credit for the kind of work that we and others have been doing in those countries, and it is so important. It really doesn't cost a lot, a tiny fraction of what we're spending in the military. And as you know, now we're now going to spend another $60 billion in the military, even though we're spending more than the next seven countries combined, including China and Russia. But the non-military side of our role is awfully important, and a number of presidents of both parties have recognized that. George W. Bush's work on AIDS in Africa has been and is terrifically important. His work and his administration's work on malaria, very important. Those are things that Donald Trump ought to be paying attention to and spending some time on, and I hope he will.
Well, I mean, it doesn't seem like it because the budget that has been shared so far seems to be slashing almost all that kinds of programming. I last year was a fellow with the U.S. Institute of Peace that does a lot of conflict resolution, peace building around the world, completely eliminating their budget altogether, eliminating within the State Department these kinds of programs, gender programs, health programs, and instead funneling the money to defense and also to, and even domestically on the domestic front, to like Homeland Security programs that, for example, countering radicalization. There's a new agency within Homeland Security called Countering Islamic Extremism. It used to be CVE, which is Countering Violent Extremism, which took into account that white militant nationalists are one of our greatest domestic threats, but now it's being reframed as Countering Islamic Extremism, which actually I did want to talk to you a little bit about because you touched on the hypocrisy that we show in our foreign policy, and this is through many administrations on both sides of the party, our alliance with Saudi and other such very, very repressive regimes that I think really have been fueling a rise in, I don't want to call it radicalization, but, you know, like, I mean, they use terrorism as a pretext to continue to oppress people. But this is an issue that countries are trying to grapple with how to deal with this now that there has been this reaction from people.
It's true. But again, we went through a terrible period in the 1970s where this was happening all over Europe, including, by the way, in the UK with the situation in Ireland. But beyond that, in the continental Europe, domestic terrorist groups, many of them young, engaging in this kind of thing in an interesting way. Europe seemed to be able to deal with that fairly successfully, I think, in part because the EU was involving and evolving. And obviously, that's an important issue going forward. But it's not as if we haven't seen these problems before. And I think we can deal pretty effectively with them, despite the tragedy of people losing their lives. My own concern is much more broader in the sense that, as I said earlier, the notion of anyone using a nuclear weapon is just unthinkable. And if you were to say to me, of all of the things that are happening these days, what's the most important? I think it's dealing with the one country of the world that doesn't seem to understand just how important it is that nuclear weapons not be used in any way or threatened. And I would hope that the United States would never do that. I mean, right now, the Pentagon is planning to spend, are you ready for this? $1 trillion to modernize our nuclear arsenal. What's that all about? What's that all about? I thought we were committed to getting rid of nuclear weapons. And that includes interesting people like Henry Kissinger, who supports that, and lots of others. That's what we ought to be doing, not spending $1 trillion we don't have to modernize our nuclear arsenal. I mean, that seems to me unthinkable.
Hi, listeners of the 45th podcast. I know you guys are just like me, Sarah, and Susan. You guys are avid learners and are always searching to learn more. That's why the three of us are big fans of the Great Courses Plus video learning service. the great Courses Plus offers fascinating video lectures on just so many different topics, and they're presented by award-winning experts. You can learn more about politics, world history, religion, how to take better pictures, even, yes, science, in the wake of the big science marches. Amazing video lectures on all facets of science. I really want you to try the great Courses Plus, so they are giving our listeners a special chance to stream their hundreds of courses for free, including one of my favorites, the Everyday Gourmet, Rediscovering the Lost Art of Cooking. Now, here's the thing. I have been cooking for at least 25 years. I am a home cook. I can whip up things, you know, very quickly, but I do have a rotation of stuff that I make over and over again because I'm comfortable with it, and I'm a little bit scared to go out of those boundaries. One of the things I almost never make is seafood. My poor family's deprived. I started watching this video series, Rediscovering the Lost Art of Cooking, and one of the lecture series here is called Seafood from Market to Plate, and I learned so much from how to make a ceviche, which is so much easier than I thought, and I love ceviche. I love it. To how and why to roast a fish whole. I always thought it was kind of weird to roast an entire fish, you know, with the skin and the bones, the head, but there's actually a reason behind it. It makes it much more flavorful, and anyhow, it's so easy to do. So I learned a lot of useful tips, and I think you guys would love not just this series, but many of the other ones, including the ones on politics and history. Well, I want you to try the Great Courses Plus. So as one of my listeners, please sign up for the Great Courses Plus with our special URL, and you are immediately going to get a free month, one whole month, 30 days of unlimited access to all of their lectures. Let me say that again. You get one whole month, unlimited access to every single one of their lectures if you sign up using thegreatcoursesplus.com/45. Again, it's thegreatcoursesplus.com/45. Sign up today. Remember, thegreatcoursesplus.com/45. So one of Susan and I are both attorneys, and other than this podcast, and we spent a lot of time working on criminal justice issues and wrongful conviction cases. And you had mentioned that, you know, Rex Tillerson is maybe one of the more mature appointees. One of the other appointees we're a little bit concerned about and paying attention to is Jeff Sessions. You, by President Bush, were called a card-carrying member of the ACLU, as if that was a bad thing many years ago, because of your very liberal stance on crime and criminals, which became a major issue in your election. And so I'm assuming criminal justice and criminal justice reform are issues that you are still very concerned about. And can you talk to us about that?
Sure. But the question is, what issues and how do you affect this? I mean, Sessions is a pretty scary guy, in my opinion. He's got an attitude about not just criminal justice, immigration and so forth, which has been extreme for years. And in my opinion, was a terrible choice. On the other hand, my state now has the lowest homicide rate in the United States. Little old Massachusetts. Well, how come? I mean, I don't think we're any more holy. You know, we don't have some kind of spiritual presence around that other people don't have. We're just another state. A good one in many ways. Probably the best school system in the country. And now a 3% unemployment rate.
Where do you live? Because I might want to move there.
No. But we do have, without the death penalty, the lowest homicide rate in America, something which unfortunately I didn't really explain and defend effectively during the campaign. How come? Because we have the toughest gun control laws in the country, bar none. If you're caught in Massachusetts carrying a concealed weapon without a license to carry it, and those are issued only by police chiefs and then sparingly, you go to jail for a year. Mm. And we have the lowest homicide rate in the country. Now, I don't understand this gun culture. I don't understand the National Rifle Association. I mean, when I was a kid, I was a pretty good shot. I competed with a rifle. I was an expert rifleman in the Army. But letting people walk around with concealed weapons, or in these cases now, unconcealed weapons, and justifying it by the Second Amendment, which even my classmate at law school, Antonin Scalia, clearly said didn't mean that governments couldn't regulate weapons, and especially concealable weapons. This makes no sense to me. Am I concerned about other criminal justice issues as well? Yes. We went through a very tough period in the 80s and the 90s when crack cocaine was out and people getting shot every day in neighborhoods all over the country, including here. And homicide rates went up and that kind of thing. I think we're beginning to achieve some degree of balance, although I don't think we have anywhere near the kind of investment in rehabilitation programs for inmates that will make it much less likely, and we have solid evidence of this, much less likely that they will go out after they complete their prison terms and commit crimes over again. But if we're serious about getting violence under control, then being tough on guns is an essential part of that. And I'd like to think that the example of my own state today is clear proof of that. So why is Congress in the hip pocket of the NRA? I don't know. I don't know, because I don't think, I know that the vast majority of Americans don't buy this. And that's an important criminal justice issue, which I think we really have to work on.
So you're probably more familiar with than anyone with sort of the effect where being rational about criminal justice issues can be seen as a weakness in a politician. But my own sense is that at least in the past 5 years or so, it's become a bit better in that regard, and that it seems more of a bipartisan focus on criminal justice reform. Is that your impression as well, or how do you think we're evolving in that area?
In certain respects, yes. I mean, I think being somewhat more reasonable about putting people in jail, for example, for simple drug possession makes a lot of sense. We're beginning to see, although awfully slowly, some focus on what happens to an inmate when he arrives in jail, and whether or not over the course of his incarceration, serious efforts are made to connect with that person, see if we can develop job skills, deal with their drug and alcohol problems. You know, 90% of the people in jail are there because of drugs and alcohol. And that's been the case for decades. There's nothing new about this. What are we doing about that? I mean, those are the kinds of issues that I'm particularly concerned about when it comes to state criminal justice systems and correctional systems. So I think we have come to be somewhat more reasonable. But without sounding like a broken record here, if we don't get serious about guns, this constant plague of violence and mass violence and mass shooting by people who quite obviously have serious mental health problems is going to continue. And I hope people understand this. I mean, it seems crystal clear to me. And again, I offer the example of this state as one where, in point of fact, we don't put up with this pro-gun nonsense. And we've got very, very low levels of violence. And as I said earlier, the lowest homicide rate in the country. So yeah, there is some movement in the way of reform. And I think we're being a lot more sensible about that. But you know, if you've got people walking around with guns who have serious mental and emotional problems, don't be surprised if we have these incidents. I mean, it's almost every week that we have another one of these mass killings someplace.
They're now local news events. They don't even make national news when you have mass shootings.
It's really sad. Yeah, it's terrible.
So your comments raised two issues for me, Governor. And the first is this, that, you know, you cited the statistics from your state and advocates of gun control and criminal justice reform, and you know, who tie these things together, have been showing these kind of statistics and publicizing them for years. I mean, we know from Europe. I mean, all over. I mean, Canada. I mean, like, it's very clear. There's a connection here between gun control and crime rates. But one of the big, I think, challenges we're facing is the fact that almost facts don't matter anymore. The propagation of there's fake news, false news, but even when there isn't, it almost seems that facts don't change people's minds. And that's what's really troubling. Like, I don't know how to battle that. That's one issue that concerns me. The other one is this, which is kind of unrelated, but, you know, Susan mentioned that there seems to be a bipartisan move towards criminal justice reform on different levels. But then you have Jeff Sessions coming in. And one of the things we talk about a lot is kind of the GOP, the leadership complicity and quietness, watching the tremendous changes this administration is making, even on their on the policies that they seem to be moving in one direction and this administration is rolling back, and why there isn't more of a vocal, verbal pushback from traditional GOP leadership and traditional conservatives on these issues.
Well, let me give this a shot. The Republican Party has changed dramatically over the course of the past 15 or 20 years. I worked with some terrific Republicans during my political career. We used to call them moderate Republicans. We even talked about some of them as liberal Republicans. They were more conservative than we Democrats were on economic issues. But when it came to civil rights, when it came to civil liberties, when it came to the environment, in my state at least, it was the Republican political leadership which led the way on environmental protection. All of those people are no longer in the Republican Party. They're either Democrats or they're independents. And the Republican Party has been taken over by right-wingers, Tea Partiers, call them what you will, who are committed to in what is my in my judgment is an extremist political philosophy. I don't know what the rest of us do about that. I think the only thing we can do is go out and beat them and make sure we have political leadership in this country, regardless of whether there's a D or an R next to its name, which has a sense of values, which I hope respects some of the things that we've been talking about, including criminal justice reform. And it's, at least for the foreseeable future, going to be the responsibility of the Democratic Party to provide that kind of leadership. That's why I think the notion of a 50-state grassroots campaign is just so critical, and I hope that my party will commit to it. Sorry I got to leave you, but thanks for the opportunity to chat with you.
Well, thank you.
Yeah, thank you so much for being with us. Thank you.
Okay.
Take care.
Bye-bye. Bye-bye.
Well, that was a fantastic conversation. There were so many more issues and questions that, you know, his responses like gave rise to in my mind. And I really valued his perspective, especially on foreign policy issues and the U.S. being part of a global mindset and not thinking that we police the world and look turning to international bodies to help resolve conflicts. I really appreciated that.
Yeah. So you guys should know that Robbie prepared this nice, like pretty comprehensive outline for us to cover. And there's
we
just so
to.
Much that he had to talk about that we couldn't even get to a lot of it because there's just so much to talk about. And it seems that he is still very much aware of what the problems are in the Democratic Party and has some serious ideas on how to fix it. As he put it, I guess you'll learn from experience.
But, you know, when he was talking about this grassroots campaign, you know, I mean, like, this is the question that occurred to me as he's discussing that. Okay, that is a strategy to win the next election. So then the GOP will come back with their strategy. And I feel like we're on a pendulum. We're going from Barack Hussein Obama to Donald J. Trump. And the United States, instead of kind of discovering what its nature is, what its values are, like we seem to be swinging so wildly in two opposite directions. Is this going to go between election to election, between administration to administration? And, you know, I was thinking of Jimmy Carter, you know, as he was talking about this. And then from Jimmy Carter going to Bush, I just feel like, how is this going to work in the long run if we can't commit to one set of kind of an American culture, right? I mean, what is the American culture, political culture now mean, even? It can be so many things that are wildly different. And I don't know if that's a good or bad thing.
I thought it was interesting there was a direct sort of parallel between his views on campaigning and Democratic Party sort of long-term procedure and his views on foreign policy. And that it can't be what you're just saying about the constant zoom back and forth, the constant in-the-moment maximizing gains, maximizing each state on a as it comes basis. And we can't run around fixing all the problems in the world. We can't be appalled at a crisis in one country and zoom in and try and fix it. And then the next one comes along. It has to be a process. It has to be a long-term plan that sometimes requires short-term losses to have a systematic, organized approach to how we approach both world crises and domestic politics, which I really enjoyed hearing. And it's not something I think I was aware of before and about his political beliefs and political philosophy, but one I very much am on board with. And that, I mean, yes, the tragedies in, well, all over the world, but in Syria right now, they it's hard to look at that and not do everything you can immediately to fix it. But there is a long-term cost to that. And the best way to stop that long-term, the best way to have a world where it's 6-6 of the world in peace and not just 5-6, is to develop institutions like the UN and work through those to systematically approach each crisis that comes along.
Okay, well, I mean, I think, you know, the idea of America as a global leader, as somebody who needs to be on the forefront, not leading from behind, leading from the front, being a moral authority. I mean, these are ideas that have also been politicized and used by administrations, I think, to, you know, to implement like their policies. But when you take a step back and look at like kind of what's fueling it, like why is it so important for America, the United States, to have this huge military industrial complex? I mean, the money, I think following the money is really important, following the economic and financial interests of corporations that are making billions and billions of dollars off of our military interventions, off of mass incarceration, all of these things. And I think that's, at the end of the day, they're the ones who win this game.
It could be the money, and it probably is, but for me, I keep going back to the soundbite culture. It keeps, the reason we want to have a strong military is so the politician can say, look at the military built up. And the reason we want to have ridiculous incarceration rates and ridiculous sentence lengths is so that the politician can say, look how tough on crime I am. In many ways, Dukakis is the anti-soundbite candidate, which is, as I saw in 88, why he lost. Because even when asked with a question intended to evoke a personal response, he maintained a very rational and reasonable approach to governance, and that was considered a weakness.
I think John Kerry was similar in that. He was an anti-soundbite a politician. He really was thoughtful in responses. I think President Obama, even though I think he's very deliberate and thoughtful, I think he was able to kind of package things into sound bites that were media friendly, and we liked them and we liked to hear them. We liked to put them on buttons and stuff like that. Like yes, you can, and other things. I think you're right. It's really interesting. I haven't thought about that. Is like the PR behind it.
Obama is like the master code switcher. He can match any cultural like need of the moment and be able to communicate in a different way in a split second like that. I mean, I remember I saw him one time in person, and just watching him like move around, and this was before he was ever elected, I was immediately impressed with how everyone he talked to, he could like switch how he was approaching them based on like, is it a college student? Is it like a old like party official? And instantly sort of meet their tone in how he talked to them. And I think that's also shows up in how he can be a soundbite culture kind of guy, when it needs to be, and then also have very reasonable, moderated responses when the forum is more appropriate for that.
Right. He's pretty good on Ellen's show, too. You're right. he knows his audience. Well, thank you guys so much for joining us this week again on the 45th Podcast, and we will see you next week. Thanks for tuning in again this week, and we really hope to keep coming to you weekly, but in order to do that, we do need your support, so please consider becoming a patron of the 45th Podcast. To do that, just go to our Patreon page. It's www.patreon.com/45thpod. Again, that's patreon.com/45thpod, and Patreon is spelled P-A-T-R-E-O-N. A big thank you, of course, to everybody who helps make this show possible, beginning with our fantastic sponsors. Thank you for supporting us. Thank you to Ray Gaines for our audio production, our kick-ass producer, Mithal Thelhan. Thank you. You are the best. We have been produced by Long Arc Digital Media, and you can find us on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram. Our handle is @45thpod. Please do check out our website at www.45thpod.com. And you can reach us and leave us your listener messages, which we love to check into, at 202-670-8345. Again, it's 202-670-8345. Thanks again. See you guys next week.
Sorry I got to leave you, but thanks for the opportunity to chat with you.
Well, thank you.
Yeah, thank you so much for being with us. And when you dropped off for a minute, Susan and I both agreed we'd vote for you if you ran again. So thanks for your time.
Don't tell Kitty. I'm not sure. She's as engaged as ever and is doing incredible work in the mental health field. But I'm not sure she's ready for another presidential campaign. Anyway,
thank you so much. Thank you so much for your work.
Appreciate it.
Thank you. Okay. Take care.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.